This is WGN. You are listening to the Wind Trust Business Lunch. Hi, I'm John Williams. Pete Zimmerman is our producer. We'll be here till 1 o'clock, then Nana DeVlantis gets rolling. I hope you can stick around for that. And for that matter, Ro Khan all the way through Nick DiGilio at night. I'll be here tomorrow. But anyway, let's get going with the show today. I'm very interested in what's happening at the retail level. We've also been talking about what has been happening with the stock markets as well, or the markets generally. I happened to walk through Nordstrom yesterday on my way to the L. I took the train yesterday back home. And one of the ways to get quickest there is to actually cut through Nordstrom. A lot of folks do. And I was amazed at how few people were in there. It was a little disheartening. I was amazed mostly at how much less merchandise was in the store as well. And you thought, fewer people with fewer products to purchase. So I went upstairs then to where the men's department is. I thought, I'll just see what clothes are out there. And there were great prices, by the way. Sales everywhere enticing me to buy. And I was looking at a $160 shirt that I can now get for $69. And I thought, well, maybe I'll do that. And then I thought, I got nowhere to wear that shirt to. And therein lies the frustration for maybe the retailers. Brian Battle joins us now. He's the director and principal at Performance Trust. Visit performancetrust.com. Brian, you're on WGN Radio again. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, John. I'm glad to be here.
I don't know if you have a comment about that observation, but I think it's hard for retailers to, A, make it when they don't have as much stuff and they don't have as many people.
Yeah, retailers specifically, this is going to be difficult for them because they're, you know, they rely on foot traffic. But this is a trend that's already was extant that is just going to accelerate. You know, people are shopping more online. Certainly people under 30 shop online more. So less stuff in the store in Nordstrom probably is going to be mirrored by more stuff for sale online at Nordstrom. So I think you have to look at it in the totality. But I think the brick and mortar retailers are pivoting. You know, Walmart is even selling more stuff online. So there was some fear that Amazon would wipe out brick and mortar retailers. And the fact is the brick and mortar people are rotating towards the Amazon model. But it is discouraging to see that people are still locked down and isn't the virus that's slowing the U.S. economy down. It's the lack of supply and demand, and that's a function of quarantine. You know, we've been told to stay home, don't go to work, don't go out in public, wear a mask, and that's what's hurting the economy, not the virus. You know, the virus seems like a scary, nebulous thing. We know exactly what's wrong with the U.S. economy. We've shut it down.
Yeah. Hold on one second. Stay right there, Brian. You got things to say, and we want to ask you about them. We're going to hang up on you. We're going to call you right back and get you a less clunky line. I will note that U.S. retail sales increased more than expected in June. I'm now reading from Reuters, but a resurgence in new COVID-19 cases is chipping away at the budding recovery. Retail sales rose 7.5% last month after jumping 18.2% in May, which was the highest gain since the government started tracking that series in 1992. This is a real glasses half empty or half full situation. Retail sales are going up. The point is they were down so low. Brian, are you still there?
I am here. Yes, I am.
Ah, yep. That's a lot better. So, right. Maybe we're shifting online rather than brick and mortar, but are retail sales recovering? Are they on a positive path? What's your overall view of that?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. Retail sales are making a monster recovery. I mean, retail sales month over month are up 7.5%. But as you pointed out, it's from the cataclysm of May. So we're going to have trouble with economic statistics in the next year, because we've had this weird transitory event here in March, April, May, where everything was closed. So that just makes the time series less valuable, because there's a bunch of static and there's a bunch of noise. Something that doesn't ever happen happened. So the statistics are absolutely true that sales are way up, but from a really, really low level. So I would be cautious on any economic statistics, including unemployment. You know, the president will say, we've had the greatest increase in employment ever. Right, it's because it was zero a couple of months, ago. So both are true things, but as for analysis, I think the economic and statistic numbers are going to be full of noise.
Yeah.
I'm way more interested in the empirical data rather than the economic data.
I keep waiting for, I'm not hoping for, but I keep waiting for, say, these retail woes or the employment woes to catch up to the stock market, and that doesn't seem to be happening.
Yeah, I think the stock market reflects future valuation. What do people think businesses are worth in the future? Like, can they produce revenue? Will they employ people? Will people buy their products? And it seems the stock market is signaling two things. One is what goes up must go up, right? So there's sort of some momentum to the stock market just keeps going higher. People don't want to miss out on it. But also that this virus quarantine experiment is transitory, and I've said that word before. It's a number the Federal Reserve loves to say, and that this too shall pass. So a year from now, we're going to be past all this, and the economy was in really good shape before all of this hit. So, you know, 2.5% growth is sort of what the stock market is predicting. If you look back, you know, it's been an impossible quarter, but if you look at the percentage change year to date, you know, the Dow is about unchanged, the S&P is about unchanged. But if you go back over the past 12 months, take a longer time horizon as an investor, we're about a couple percent, 6%. So the stock market isn't horrible. It isn't over, but certainly the recency bias we've had, the experience we all had in the past quarter is traumatizing.
Boy, isn't that the truth? Well, I'll close, but on a note of optimism from you then, right?
Yeah, sure. You know, so what does this really mean? So we have empirical data. We're in earnings season, so businesses are going to tell us, this is what we think the economy looks like. Here's how we're going to posture going forward. And we have empirical data out of the state of Texas. They released that. The state of Texas doesn't have income tax. They have a lot of sales tax. And their sales taxes were down 15% in April, which is a big number, but it was right in the teeth of the crisis. So the state of Texas is going to reduce their budget by 5% for the next fiscal year. That's not a disaster. That seems really, really manageable. So this close to the quarantine and the end of the quarantine, it's hard to see, and there's no historical allegory. We've never done this before. But the data that we're getting now and the price of the stock market and real sales data from Texas is sort of indicating to me that we're kind of coming out of this, and this is going to be a temporary thing. But it's hard as we go through.
Brian Battle, Performance Trust. Visit performancetrust.com for more insight like that. Brian, thanks for your time today.
You're welcome, John.
You have a good day. Speaking of tech, Ian Schur joins us on WGN Radio. He is one of the editors and editor-at-large at CNET.com. Hi, Ian. Welcome back.
Hi. How are you doing?
Really good. I don't think any of us were happy to hear that the likes of Elon Musk or Bill Gates got hacked, but I think a lot of us sort of said, okay, it's not just me who finds themselves vulnerable. You feel stupid if something happens to you, but lo and behold, the smartest guys in the room, it happened to them too, huh?
It did, and unfortunately, this is something that has a lot more implications than simply Elon Musk or Bill Gates having a bad password. We found out that yesterday when a bunch of Twitter accounts were hacked for what appeared to be a Bitcoin scam. What happened was that apparently the hackers got access to the tools that Twitter itself uses to manage its site. And they did this through a very basic thing. It appears they just sent an email or some other thing that convinced the employees to give their password from Twitter, and then suddenly they were in. It's really a problem for Twitter going forward because they have these blue check marks on Elon Musk and on Barack Obama and on Kanye West and on presidential candidate Joe Biden. And we are supposed to trust that when they tweet, we can trust that what they're saying in that tweet was written by them or authorized by them. And now that it appears people can take control of these accounts, it really undermines a lot of what Twitter's been trying to do.
Yeah, those blue check marks the verified accounts are very coveted, too. It means, you know, in a way that you are a significant enough player that we have taken extra steps to make sure that you are what you say you are. So if they have access to that, well, then the platform loses a lot of legitimacy. I wonder who would have done that, Ian. I mean, was it Russians or teenagers in Ohio? Who did this?
I mean, it could be either or. And I do know I was tracking. You can see publicly how much money goes into a Bitcoin account as part of the system. So I actually tracked over $115,000 that went into that account. So they made that money. But, you know, look, anyone who wants to undermine Twitter, whether it's state-sponsored hacking or whomever else, they've certainly succeeded here. And it's worth noting, you know, and it's probably obvious to a lot of people, but we've got the President of the United States doing diplomacy on Twitter, and now I can't trust that everything he tweets is what he says, and that's a problem.
Oh, you're worried that something crazy might appear on Donald Trump's Twitter account?
No comment.
Actually, if it was just even, I would say, okay, the thing has been hacked. If it's not all caps and underlined with exclamation points, I'd say, that's not our president. So what was this thing about the money, though? I mean, how did it actually turn into cash or Bitcoin for somebody?
So what happens is that in the hacked messages, which we have copies of on CNET, what happened was that they said stuff like, I'm feeling generous because of COVID-19. I'll double the amount of money you send me in this address, right? So people would send $1,000 to supposedly Elon Musk's Bitcoin address and hoping to get $2,000 back. And, of course, the hackers just kept the money. But these types of scams exist all over Twitter, but typically they kind of go nowhere because the people who are putting up the scams are not blue check marks and well-known figures.
Right.
So at least $115,000 worth of people were tricked into this thing.
Have they fixed it?
Yes. So Twitter had to shut down a lot of the site yesterday to allow fixes to happen, and even now they're still investigating everything. We don't know all of the details of what happened, but it appears as though they fixed it. But as far as I'm concerned personally, they have not fixed the trust issue. Along with all the other problems I have with Twitter, and the list is long, this is now a new huge problem that we're going to have going forward if I can't trust what people tweet is what they wanted to tweet.
For most of us, it'll continue to work. What other problems, though, do you have for Twitter?
A lot of my issues around them is harassment. The company, and I've written about this on CNET many times, the company, from my opinion and also the opinion of many anti-hate groups that I've spoken to, including the Anti-Defamation League and others, is that the company just doesn't take enough steps to stop hate from being spread on the platform. And that's not just indoctrination of white supremacy and a lot of other issues, but it's also hate campaigns, right? Groups of people who go around and actually harass other people on the platform. And this happens a lot. And there are signs that, you know, there are some people who they do this to, and they'll release the person's name, their address, their phone number of family and friends, and suddenly everyone in their family is being harassed and their lives are being ruined. And this is all happening on Twitter. And to me, it's unacceptable that we've known about this problem for over a decade, and the company has still failed to actually fix it.
It's fascinating to me that somebody sitting somewhere, maybe half the world away, with a computer, is able to somehow type something on their screen, and then they gain access to Bill Gates' Twitter account.
Huge problem.
you almost want to champion the ingenuity of the person that knows how to do that. I mean, that's just flabbergasting to me. Of course, it's criminal and it's unethical. It's all wrong. But you would think that would be complicated enough and that Twitter would be smart enough that would be impossible. I mean, did you think somebody somewhere was screaming in a room full of techs at Twitter, just absolutely losing it over this?
Oh, I'm sure they were. And today was probably not a fun day for any of Twitter's engineers or security people. But the thing I do point out to people, and I have to give Twitter a little bit of leeway here, is is that all software has bugs, right? Software is written by humans. Humans are fallible. Thus, software is fallible. And the constant trick is having the best security people working for you who find the bugs before the hackers do. And this is one of those things where, in fact, it wasn't about a bug. It was about social engineering, right? The worst part of problem where the hackers convinced people who had access to give over their accounts to the hackers, either through social engineering or tricking them or whatever else. And that is the worst thing, is that Twitter appears to have not taught its employees well enough to avoid these types of things so that it wouldn't happen.
I've taken too much time on this topic, so just give me 60 seconds on the Peacock Network. Is this free, really free? What are they doing?
Well, it is kind of free. So they're offering two-thirds of their videos to be able to watch. And this is a new streaming service from NBC Universal, competes against CBS, which is my employer, HBO Max, and Netflix. And what they're trying to bring to the table, other than trying to get another couple bucks out of your pocket every month, is that they have a bunch of shows that you probably have known about, 30 Rock, you've got Battlestar Galactica, one of the most famous sci-fi shows that have happened, and then also it has its own shows, which we've reviewed on CNET. And they're offering this free tier where with advertising you get to watch the stuff, kind of like Hulu. Whether or not it'll work is a real question, and I'm really curious to see. I mean, again, this is yet another streaming service. I don't know how many of these people I'm willing to pay to. So I have to really wonder how this is all going to play out.
Ian Schur is the editor-at-large at CNET. Visit CNET.com to read more like this. Nice to talk to you, Ian. Thanks for your thoughts today.
Take care.
12:33 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Probably no business, large, medium, small, is without IT challenges, particularly now. We do a commercial for Dr. Tech. In fact, I'm going to put one of the people on from Dr. Tech right now. It seems to me like IT challenges are just such an issue. You know, it's like, are these computers working for me or are we working for them? And then you say, okay, but now those desktops that people are working at in the office, well, they're not there. They're operating from home. Now we need connectivity from home back to the server at the office. We need people to be able to share documents. And that's just some basic stuff. It gets more complicated after that. So let's see what's going on out there and what some of the solutions are. Kevin McCullough is the CIO. I believe that would be the Chief Information Officer at Dr. Tech. Hey, Kevin, you're on WGN Radio. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
CIO, is that Information Officer?
Yes, it is.
I understand that you guys have been in business for, is it 20 years in Chicago?
It's, yep, 20 years, Chicago and throughout the nation. We've got, you know, some of our customers, we do work for Chase, Jewel, most every fast food place we've done work for.
It's interesting to me that you would be working for brands as high profile as that. I would think they would have their own technology people to resolve whatever issues they have.
A lot of them, they have some on-site, and then they contract a lot of the work out. They've scaled back on-site, and then they supplement with contract IT people.
What would be an example of something you would do for them or for anybody, for that matter?
Phone rollouts, new servers coming in, putting in new racks for servers, cabling, cable abatement is a big thing right now.
What is that? What is cable abatement? What does that mean?
Removing old cables that aren't in use or that are in bad condition and putting in new ones. With fire codes, you don't want the old ones hanging around. In fact, there's one fire code that if it's not in use, you have to remove it.
Really? Although I must say, you can go to plenty of businesses, homes, and there's just bundles of cables tied up in a basement or behind a closet wall somewhere, and you don't even know what those are anymore.
Right, and a lot of them just aren't needed. And like in the city of Chicago, all of it now is supposed to be in conduit, and most aren't. And originally I thought that was kind of silly, and I talked with a fireman, and he was like, no, it's not really a fire issue. It's when there is a fire that those cables fall and the firemen get tangled in them.
Imagine that. You also said that you guys do phone work or phone system rollouts. What does that mean?
When you're getting a new phone system or just replacing the desktop phones, we prepare all the phones, configure them, put them on the desk, make sure they work, take the old ones out, and get rid of them for you, usually after hours, and that way then we stay the following day or two for support, just in case someone needs it or needs some basic training on how to use their phone.
All of this sounds like stuff you would have done pre-COVID. How has your world or your client's world changed since?
A lot of people have just closed down, unfortunately. We now have a system. It came out of Japan, actually, but when you come in, it scans the person, takes their temperature. If you want, it'll check if they have a mask. And you can have it as a standalone unit, or you can put it with a door lock, and if they don't meet the temperature or don't have a face mask, the door doesn't unlock, so they can't even get in. And then that also gives you proof that you have been screening, because you can set it up. Well, it'll take a quick snap, date stamp it, and put the temperature on it. So then, especially like schools, well, any business, really, someone comes to you and says, hey, I got COVID at your place. You can pull up and say, see, we've been screening. Here's our proof.
Yeah, we've done everything we can do. But let's just talk about that for a minute. So if a public school, a private school, any building, but let's just think about a school for a minute, want to tell its community that we're going to do everything we can to ensure the safety of the kids, faculty, and staff, and it's the only thing we can do, we can't give a COVID test to everybody at the door. That's impractical. But we could check for temperature, and we can make sure they're wearing a mask. Now, you could have people at every door doing that, or you could have this gadget you're talking about automatically do that, and it would record. You'd have a picture of, a recording of the temperature and that person's image. Is that correct?
Correct. And then if they don't have, like in a school setting, you could set it up where a red light and an alarm goes off so that someone can go, okay, I've got a kid that I need to go see what's going on.
Right. Or slide your mask up or do some sort of additional check to make sure this person should or should not pass. But then how does it keep the door from opening up?
Well, you set it up with, it's called access control. It's an electronic magnetic lock. And when they meet the criteria, they don't have a temperature, they have their mask on, the magnet unlocks, they go in, and the door closes and locks them automatically again.
Can you set it up with facial recognition with the face mask to make sure that this is somebody authorized to come in?
Yes. If you're wanting it, you can do it that way. You can set it up where only, you know, your employees can get in or your students can get in.
Yeah. Now, some people might say, I think I'm ceding too much control to the machine here. What do you say about that?
Some do. It's already here. Most cities, especially Chicago, they have facial recognition everywhere. But you can turn that part off and just use it as a screening and not do the actual facial recognition. It's just going to scan you for your temperature.
Yeah.
And if you have a mask.
So just a health screening, if you will, not a identity screen that way.
Right. So you can turn that part off if you don't want it.
Yeah.
So you could even set it with a door that doesn't matter who it is, as long as they don't have a temperature and they have a mask, they can come in.
But you can actually, you would seem to me like if I had something from my nose on down, you could, the technology would still, based on, now you're just going to see maybe my hair and my eyes, I guess. You would be able to know if somebody is who they say they are?
Yeah, and it can tell that. It also can tell if it's a person, and I've tested it. Some people will try and just hold up like a picture, and this will even know if it's a live person or if you're just trying to sneak
really?
Through it.
Yeah. Well, there's the world we live in. We're talking with Kevin McCullough, the Chief Information Officer at Dr. Tech. They've been in the Chicago area. They work throughout the country for about 20 years now. Their website is drtech.net. There's no H in that. It's D-R-T-E-C, drtech.net, to find out more. Good luck to you, Kevin. I appreciate your time today.
All right, thank you.
Have a good day. It's 12:41 on WGN. This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. Looks like the new marijuana licenses are facing another delay. It's likely to be mid-September now before any of the 75 new licenses for adult-use dispensaries are awarded. The state says they're still scoring the more than 700 applications. Go Health, a Chicago Medicare-focused health insurance marketplace, went public this week. They're on the NASDAQ. The tech company raised $914 million by offering 43.5 million shares at $21. It ended up above its target range. And American Airlines will notify 25,000 workers, that's about 29% of its U.S. workforce, that they are at risk of losing their jobs later this year as the carrier adjusts to a collapse in travel. The cuts are needed because the coronavirus pandemic is still battering demand for flights. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Steve Bertrand.
Steve Alexander's watching agribusiness for us and whatever else is on his mind.
Yeah, let's talk about whiskey.
See what I mean?
Well, it's an agricultural commodity, John, no doubt about it.
Yeah,
the whiskey acres out west.
I know them well.
Yeah. How do you like your whiskey?
Well, I like bourbon, but I'll tell you something else they make. I'm not sure what you've got up your sleeve, but one thing that they do at Whiskey Acres is they take barrel-aged, they take the bourbon-aged barrels, they put maple syrup in there, and then they sell a maple syrup with kind of a bourbon-y flavor to it. There's no alcohol in it. I had French toast this weekend for the very purpose of putting that on something. Mm. It's a very good product, but why do you bring them up?
Well, not them in particular, whiskey in general, though. If you said you liked your whiskey poured from a bottle, a paper bottle, you're in luck. Starting next year, Johnny Walker is going to be bottling its whiskey in what's called a planet-friendly paper-based bottle.
It's just like a paper bag.
Yeah, that's how I do it, Steve. Does it go good on a park bench, by the way?
The idea is to get rid of the plastic, and Diageo, the British company that owns the brand, says the paper bottle is expected to debut early next year. It's also trying to get rid of those, you know, those plastic rings on the top of six-packs of cans. They're trying to get rid of those for its Guinness brand as well. Yesterday's Twitter hack, believe it or not, paid off. Several high-profile Twitter accounts, as we've heard over and over again these last few hours, were hacked with a message saying something similar to what former President Obama's stated. I am giving back to my community due to COVID-19. All Bitcoin sent to the address below will be sent back doubled. If you send me $1,000, I will send you $2,000. Only doing this for the next 30 minutes. Enjoy. Would you send in $1,000?
No.
Of course not.
That's because I don't know what a Bitcoin is, but it's amazing that people that are that into technology that they have Bitcoins, that they would be scammed.
Yeah. According to the research firm Whitestream, a blockchain analytics company, people sent in $135,000 yesterday. Shares of Twitter, by the way, are down about 1%. American Airlines and JetBlue Airways are teaming up again. The airlines, which ended a similar partnership in 2014, unveiled a new alliance this morning that's going to allow them to sell seats on each other's planes. That could give them a better shot at fending off competitors like rivals Delta and United Airlines. Travelers can also earn and burn their frequent flyer miles with flights on either carrier. Might this lead to a merger? An American Airlines spokeswoman said the companies were focused on this partnership right now. American brings big hubs in Chicago and Dallas-Fort Worth, Charlotte, Philadelphia. JetBlue has an extensive network from New York and Boston throughout the Caribbean and northern Latin America. American shares are down about 6.5% right now, even though, as Steve mentioned, it's going to it's furloughing 25,000 employees. JetBlue shares are off about 2.6%, but all of the airline stocks are down today. UAL was trading down about 5%. Looking at the grain commodities one more time, wheat is trading 16 and a half cents lower right now. That's about 32 cents lower than what it was yesterday at this time. 534 and a quarter a bushel. Beans are up 7 cents at 893 and a quarter, and corn is trading about 4 cents higher at 330 a bushel. And that's Euro Money on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth joins us to talk still more business on WGN's Wintrust Business Lunch, and lots of chatter today, Amy, about the airline industry. What are you looking at?
Yeah, you know, it's really this continuation. So once we saw just how much travel dropped off. I think the airlines really saw the writing on the wall, knew how rough it was going to be. But then there was a little period of optimism after the initial drop-off. Well, it wasn't huge, but a little bit of, hey, okay, maybe there's a little bit of a comeback here in June. But as we're seeing coronavirus case numbers swell up again in some states, travel restrictions remain in place, really dire things are coming from leadership of airlines. American has joined that group. That's the second biggest carrier at O'Hare. I mean, it's right after United. That's a huge airline, certainly very important here. But what they've said is that they're making some plans at this point to cut up to 25,000 jobs. Now, that's in addition to a huge number of people that have already taken some voluntary separation, but have already accepted temporary leave, things like that. So about 40,000 people already accepted temporary leave. So some of them could be included in this mix. But 25,000 people, that's just a huge number. They've sent out these notices. Among them, that's about 2,500 pilots, just due to 10,000 flight attendants. And then we start looking about over 3,000 maintenance workers and, you know, gate workers and other people. I mean, it's a really, really giant number. Now, an interesting move that American also made earlier today is they have created a partnership with JetBlue. Now, the conversation for this started well before the pandemic, but it's kind of a bid to fend off United and Delta a little bit, and kind of, it's a, you know, very competitive industry that just got even more competitive with so few people flying. So essentially, JetBlue and American are going to allow sales to each other. Essentially, you can, you know, they're going to let American passengers extend their ticket out into JetBlue and vice versa. So you could theoretically, like, pick up a leg of your trip on JetBlue if you're flying American, things like that. So, you know, I think we're going to see a lot of these kind of moves from airlines to just sort of try to bolster what revenue they do have and what they can preserve, especially if we're going to see case numbers rise again and or go up any higher. And if we're going to see any other kind of travel restrictions happen or more states added to that, I think this is really just airlines saying, we got to make it. Now, a lot of them took some federal aid, but that does expire at the end of September. So what we're going to see is potentially a huge number of layoffs, tens of thousands of people across the airline industry starting October 1st. And I think a lot of people are bracing for that.
I guess if they had another round of some sort of, money for those people, maybe that would forestall that. But we don't have any idea if that's going to happen, huh?
Yeah, there was a deal made with the U.S. Treasury a week ago that kind of allows them the option to tap into more funds. But the aid that they've gotten so far was very specific to payroll, and it was very explicit in that in order to accept this money immediately, you have got to agree you cannot lay people off until at least the end of September. So as that expires, we'll see how things shake out, because some of the airlines have said, okay, we have the availability to take money from the U.S. Treasury. It doesn't mean we're going to take it, because there are strings attached to that. So we will see those moves and how that shakes out. But it's really a troubling time for the airline industry. You know, all of the leadership, as they're making statements and sending out notes to workers announcing this, they've really expressed, you know, hey, this is not something we want to do. I mean, the American CEO even used the word, I hate to do this. So,
yeah.
You know, a lot of remorse from leadership. No leader wants to make that call, but it's really this moment that the airlines are in where they, you know, earlier this week, Southwest said, if we don't triple revenue, we're going to have to do layoffs for the first time ever. So that really just paints a picture of how dire things are in the airline industry right now.
I saw from Delta that the compliance with the, voluntary leave or exit programs, they said, we'll make an offer. How about you just go away for good? 20% of the workers at Delta accepted the voluntary early retirement. 20%.
Yeah, it's significant. There's a similar deal available for American. They have until July 31st to make that decision. So about 4,500 of American's employees already left under a similar voluntary program that was offered earlier, including about 800 pilots. So, and another, I think, 5,000 or so management and white-collar workers have also agreed to exit. So, you know, again, we're looking at such a big number, but I think it would be very interesting to see what happens. How many people say yes to a voluntary leave program that that offer expires at the end of this month?
Any idea how long JetBlue and American will share their passenger list that way?
I don't really have that sense. It seems like it's going to be indefinitely. It also isn't immediately clear in all the reporting around this at various outlets exactly how much they believe they could revenue they could gain from that kind of deal. But again, this is something they had started talking about pre-pandemic. So it's obviously lucrative. It's obviously, you know, going to work for them. They had talked about, they just accelerated it a lot to make up in this moment when they, you know, both need revenue. So I think that'll be really interesting. It'll certainly, you know, if you go and you're searching for an American flight, suddenly you're going to get a lot more options because you're looking at JetBlue things too that will kind of help buffer revenue for both of them. So it seems like it's indefinite for now, but that may change. I think a lot just depends on how things go in the next few months with travel.
Last thing, Amy, what are you hearing about the distribution center on the southwest side for Amazon?
This is so interesting. So Amazon has snapped up 11 million square feet of industrial space in the Chicago area in the second quarter. That's according to Colliers International. I mean, think about 11 million square feet. That's huge. This is really the one area of commercial real estate that has not been impacted negatively by the pandemic. In fact, it's thriving right now, this industrial space sector, because so many people are not going to stores. They're ordering from e-commerce sites. And so Amazon has really promised, hey, we're going to do this faster. They've been making more and more promises about getting things to you quicker and quicker and quicker. So these are the so-called last mile distribution centers. So if more stuff is stored locally, that means if I order it, I can get it faster. I don't have to wait for it to come from another city or another market or wherever. So these are, 11 million square feet. That's really giant. That's right on the heels of last month, plans for two big fulfillment centers, one in Markham and one in Madison. That's 2,000 jobs combined in the two of them. So it's a really, you know, significant bet that Amazon is making on the Chicago area. We already have a lot of infrastructure around logistics and shipping, so I think it makes sense to do that here. But this is really part of this bigger strategy. We saw something similar from Target, who just put this, you know, plans in motion for a massive distribution center in Little Village. And so we're seeing really this moment for e-commerce where they're really scrambling to seize it.
Yeah, good news for the folks in Gage Park and all of those other locales. Nice to talk to you, Amy. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much, John.